Welcome to My Favorite Mystic, a podcast about the weird and wonderful world of mysticism. I'm AJ Langley, and today I'm joined by Bjorn Schillian. He is an associate professor of history at Mid-Sweden University, working on medieval historiography, political thought, and pastoral care. Bjorn, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much, AJ. Delighted to be here.
Delighted to have you. Now, we are going to talk about a mystic who, as far as we know, is called Margareta. But before we get into talking about her, let's talk about you. How did you find yourself in the academic world of mysticism?
It's a good question, and I'll try to come up with a not too lengthy answer. I'm really a latecomer to the field. As you said in your kind introduction, I wrote a thesis on historiography. Since then, I worked mainly on political thought, for instance, virtue ethics. Then I ended up studying pastoral care. But a few years ago, I relocated to my current university, which is situated in the north of Sweden. And I felt that I really ought to read up on the church history, in particular of the subarctic Scandinavia, of which I knew absolutely nothing. And in the course of all of the reading, there was one character that popped up, references to a character with a story that I thought was just intriguing. But it also, it really puzzled me. There was something that wasn't quite right with it. And it all concerned a woman named Margareta, a woman of Sami origin. And Sami, if they are native people of northern Scandinavia, and there's still a fairly large minority of Sami people. Margareta, she appears to have left her home up north and traveled south to visit prelates in Uppsala and other parts of central Sweden, and to urge them to improve activities of mission and pastoral care in the north. And eventually, in 1389, she even gained the support of the reigning queen, who, a bit confusingly, was also called Margareta. Margareta, the queen, anyway, she was queen of both Sweden, Norway, and Denmark at the time, in 1389. And she wrote this great letter in support of Margareta and her appeals for a mission up north. And what puzzled me really, and that no one had discussed, was why was she successful? How could an unlearned lay woman from a minority in the peripheries of the realm get the support of all these prelates and eventually from the queen? What type of contexts do you need to place her in to really understand what was going on here? That's when I had to go mystic.
Amazing. So finding Margareta introduced you to mysticism, and now you have briefly introduced her to us. So you mentioned that she is one of the Saumi people, but that she was also a Christian, and she was arguing for increased pastoral care for Christians in Saumi communities. But there's something there that doesn't add up quite right. I mean, was there an attempt for mass conversion of the Saumi, because you would expect pastoral care to be a big part of that? What's actually happening? Do we know how she became a Christian?
The story of the conversion of the Saumi is traditionally has been viewed from the lens of the Protestant Reformation, of the Lutheran Reformation, where the kind of standard idea, I think, for quite a long time was that it really got going only after the Reformation in the mid-16th century. But of course, any people up north, any Sami people who were living close to Christian communities were, of course, affected. And there was a lot of trade in between. So it's quite clear by now, not the least from the material evidence, you know, that plenty of them were baptized. And Margareta was obviously one of them, which might tell us something about where she came from. She must have come from up north, but somewhere not too far from a place where there were chapels and where there were parishes. And if you went along the Baltic in the late 1300s, you had parishes that were part of the great diocese of Uppsala, almost all the way up along the Baltic coast.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, when you were saying that you kept seeing this woman, this character, pop up in things that you were reading, what does that mean? What kind of sources do we have that talk about her? How much do we know about her life? What kind of things are available to us?
The thing is that she's frequently mentioned, of course, in any type of survey of Arctic or subarctic church history. But the actual medieval sources that talk about them, they're quite few. This is something of a five-piece puzzle, if you will. There are five letters, really, five letters of recommendation for her person and for her mission. One of these letters is the grand one from the Queen Margareta that I mentioned. And then there are four others written by Swedish prelates, and in one instance by a Franciscan friar who mentioned her and who wrote on her behalf. So we have no writings of her own hand. When I say that she was a mystic, all of this, of course, is based on the type of descriptions that you get in these sources. And of course, you might ask, are they fitting her into a pattern that they are already familiar with? And I think there are plenty of reasons to think that they did. And this is part of the excitement of all this. This is when it becomes cultural history, in a way.
Okay, so we are dealing with a real scarcity of sources here. If we're only relying on other people's descriptions of her, and these are in the format of letters kind of praising her and her mission, how much do they actually tell us about who she was or about her life?
Very, very little. Again, it is only in these sources. And then, of course, we can assume a lot of things. But the chronological range of these texts might say something. She first appears in the records in 1388, 1389. She got the great letter from the queen. But there is a late letter in this series, probably from 1414. And then she's down doing the same type of work, trying to urge the Archbishop of Uppsala to increase the pastoral care and missionary activity up north. And that would mean, if that is correct, that dating, that she has been involved in this work, roaming the land, urging for support for her good work for maybe 20 or 30 years. If that's the case, it's an extraordinary individual, of course, and quite an extraordinary achievement. And this is also how she is being described there in 1414. You know, she's recommended for having been doing this for so long for her people, who in that letter it is claimed that they are all still heathens. And of course, this has to be rectified.
Okay, so her main mission is to speak to these religious authorities and get them to support an increase in pastoral care in the northern territories. But as you mentioned earlier, there was no real concerted effort towards extensive conversion until the Reformation. So do you see this as an initiative that was her own, or is that something that is being put into these letters from another source? Do you get the sense that it is a personal cause?
It is a good question, but I do actually think that there are grounds to think that the initiative was hers. One must keep in mind that the Archbishop of Uppsala, he is responsible for the church up north. The Archdiocese of Uppsala is vast. It's probably the biggest one in Europe at the time. But of course, up there, the population is scarce. There's no real interest, perhaps, from the church authorities to expand and put down a lot of effort up there. But there are Christian communities, and then there are people like Margareta, of course, who urge him to do so. So I think that the initiative is probably hers. She had help, of course, based on these letters of recommendation. You know, people wrote for her behalf. And it's interesting to look at these writers and see who they were. We have bishops, we have a friar, we have a canon, and then, of course, we have the queen and the Archbishop of Lund. These are not nobodies. But one thing that most of them, apart from one that we might return to, have in common is that they have good links with Vadstena Abbey, that is the Abbey of the Birgittines. And I think that this is very crucial to understand all of these episodes, because when Margareta appears in central Sweden in the late 1380s, she comes at a very particular time, because this is the time when Birgitta is about to be canonized. So Birgitta of Vadstena, or Birgitta of Sweden, is probably familiar. Of course, she was a Swedish aristocrat who, when she was widowed, she started living a religious life, and she worked to institute a religious order of her own, which she managed to do in the end. It was a particular foundation in Vadstena with nuns, but also with a group of friars who were preacher friars who were situated there. But Birgitta was controversial because she had been involved in the high church politics of the time. For instance, trying to get the Pope to come back from Avignon to Rome. And this, of course, raised as much criticism as it did enthusiasm. But what I just described there is, of course, a prophetess, a visionary, who is a laywoman, but who is urging the church authorities to do their job. And there is a parallel here, of course, with what Margareta is doing, or at least what people who are in this Birgittine circle are writing that she's trying to do when she's urging the Archbishop of Uppsala to get on with things up north and take his responsibility.
To those unfamiliar with the study of mysticism, I think it would be really surprising to see how many of these women are using this connection with God in order to try and convince religious officials that they really need to be doing their job and doing a better job of their job. Obviously, in the majority of these cases, it's not the women saying it, it's God saying it or Christ saying it, and the message is just coming through them. But this is a very common theme in the works of female mystics from the late medieval period. So the correlation being drawn there between Margareta and Birgitta is actually really apt and something that we see as being really normal for women such as them.
Yeah, because what other, when you think of it, what other resources do they have? You know, and I think that this is why I started to look at this character from the angle of mysticism in a way. If you think of it as a religious, authoritative religious idiom that can be used and deployed for things like this, which is what Birgitta has just proved, of course. And that is what is happening here. In a way, you might say that she has to be described as a visionary with a message from God. She has to be described as someone who is carrying out God's work. And I mentioned one of the authors of these letters, the Friar Philip in Stockholm, who explicitly makes the parallel to Birgitta and other holy women, he writes, who are used by God as tools. And that's how he describes Margareta then as well. So you might say that this whole mystical idiom is a necessary resource to give her authority, to have the authority to egg on the actual church authorities.
So how is that mystical aspect, these experiences, this idea that Margareta is speaking for a higher authority, how is that conveyed in these sources? Because as you mentioned, we don't have her own recordings of her experience. So how do these letters of recommendation characterize her as divinely inspired?
We would love to have, of course, these long descriptions of exactly what her visions, you know, looked like and what she, you know, in particular was saying. We don't. We have allusions, though. I think she first arrived in Stockholm and she met this Friar Philip. And he writes about her in more general terms, you know, making the parallel that I just mentioned to Birgitta and other holy women. And he is probably sending her to Uppsala. In Uppsala, it appears that they are not as enthusiastic about her. They're a little bit wary, but they do write that she claims to have had divinely inspired visions and admonitions. Occultas visiones et admonitiones facta asserit, is what they say. But they also say this type of discretio spiritum, that is assessing, you know, if these emanates from spirit of truth or from a bad spirit. That's nothing they really have competence to do. So they send her on. But that is in a way the most direct reference we have to her claiming that she has some kind of vision, that she's not just urging this on any kind of reasonable grounds, or it's not just a get on with the job thing. It's also that she's inspired to do so.
That's really interesting. The discretio spiritum, or the discretion of spirits, was really important to determining whether a mystic was divinely inspired or potentially being harassed by demons or possessed. So it's interesting that they mention this, but then say that they aren't able to determine it one way or the other. Does this come up at other points in these letters?
I think it is a discourse that runs through all of them. It is most explicit in this letter from Uppsala, but you see it also in another letter, I think, from a bishop of Strängnäs, Tord, who is a great enthusiast of her. He doesn't mention the Discretio Spiritum explicitly, but you can see in the manner that he argues for her. He says, for instance, he talks about her person, that she is not someone who tries to bring attention or honor or glory to herself. Her message is in accordance with, she's doing God's law, so it's in accordance with scripture, you know, it's orthodox. It is also reasonable what she wants. Small things like that, of course, they might just come from, you know, might just be a natural way of arguing, but when you start looking at the literature of Discretio Spiritum at the time, for instance, what was written about it by Birgitta of Vadstena's editor, Alfonso of Jaén. He prefaced his editions of some of Birgitta's visions with kind of an introduction to this whole Discretio Spiritum. How do you know? And he offers criteria for how to assess both the person and the content of their visions. And he says typically things like what Tord is saying, you know, it has to be someone who is not focused on themselves. It has to be reasonable what they want, and it has to be in accordance with scripture. So I think that all of these writers, whether they support her or are a bit more wary like they are in Uppsala, they need to relate to the tradition of Discretio Spiritum. They have this big case with Birgitta going on. They, of course, they know the arguments pro and con by heart. And this is how, in order to either promote Margareta or to shut her down, they need to talk this language. So I think that it pops up in different ways through the material. This is also very interesting, of course, because it means that what at first looks like an interesting but still peripheral episode, you know, a curiosity with this Sami woman coming down to central Sweden and trying to get support, you realize that that is part of something much larger. This is a discussion about the authority in the church and the role of mysticism and individual revelation in the church. And all of this then kind of takes shape in the person of Margareta and her mission.
And as you say, she ended up having a fair amount of support, not only from these religious authority figures, but from the queen as well. Do we know how their connection came about? Do we know if they met or if Margareta approached the queen to ask for assistance? Do we know how this letter of endorsement came into being?
This is a very good question, of course. And there are a number of answers that one might suggest. Central, I think, both religiously and institutionally, is Vadstena Abbey again. I mentioned Bishop Tord. His very enthusiastic letter in support of Margareta was, with all likelihood, for the friar brothers in Vadstena. He wanted them to recommend Margareta and her project to the queen, Margareta, because they knew that they had the queen's ear, and she was a great supporter of Vadstena. So that's one thing. We can assume that they did just that and that it worked. When it came to the queen herself, she might have had multiple reasons. One is that this is in 1389. She is only, since a few months back, ruler of Sweden. She was ruler of Denmark and Norway before, and she's been invited into Sweden to oust the current king, Albrecht of Mecklenburg. And she has succeeded to do so. But of course, she needs to gain a firmer hold also of the Swedish clergy and to gain support. And one theory might be that, you know, doing Vadstena's bidding in this case, in a way, helps herself as well. The great letter that she wrote, based on the information she had from Margareta, her Sami informer, is of course partially addressed to the Archbishop of Uppsala. He's the one who's supposed to get on with things, you know. And the queen reminds him that, well, if he does, she has very good connections in Rome, and this might prove, you know, helpful for him. It's a part threat, I suppose, and part promise of rewards. Did they meet, the two Margaretas? Well, I would love to think so, but we really can't say. Margareta, that is the visionary, she's mentioned in this great letter only as a woman of the Uppsala diocese, you know, and she has handed over information about this. But we do have some little clues, perhaps fitting for this show, about the queen's own religious inclinations that also might give us some kind of guidance. But this comes from just fairly spurious mentionings in some Vastena material in the Vastena Diarium, the great kind of chronicle of Vastena, where they say that the queen, she has told the brothers that she knew of a woman, and of course it's understood that she's talking about herself, who had a dream, and in the dream a woman clothed in a particular way that makes you think of the Brigittine nuns, and she's probably talking about Birgitta herself, who visited her and admonished her to support the brothers in Vastena and everything will go well. So she might have had a bit of a visionary temperament herself, or at least the brothers in Vastena liked to think so, and how fitting that it was to support them that she was urged to do.
I mean, even though, as you say, we have no actual firm evidence for it, and these are potentially spurious claims, I really like the idea that she had a prophetic dream, and because of this was potentially more sympathetic towards female mystics and wanting to support their activities. There's something about that that I really like, and I want it to be true.
But I don't think we can rule it out. Neither do I think that we can rule out the fact that a medieval ruler like Margareta, a king or a queen, also might take the responsibilities, their religious responsibilities for the spiritual well-being of their subjects seriously. She was now the head of the Swedish realm as well. And maybe she actually felt that it was part of her responsibility. It wasn't okay. Even if this is what the church should do, it wasn't okay that part of her realm up there in the north, that the church wasn't organized properly, that religious instruction wasn't proper, that people didn't have a chance to regularly perhaps visit the churches that they should do. I don't think we should rule out that. But then, of course, there's always a cynical kind of backside to it. Expansion north, that is making people, you know, tax paying subjects, would of course always involve that the church has to be established. The kind of kingly rule and the church are part and parcel of the same organization, in a way, of authority. So I think for the one to be efficiently established, you must have the other first.
On this point of the queen and citizenship and expanding and the church and state together, one of the things you mentioned about the queen's letter kind of promoting Margareta is that she refers to her as a citizen of the Uppsala diocese. Is there a mention in these letters that she is Saumi? Does that seem to be a factor in how she's portrayed in these letters or the way that she's potentially used as a character?
That's another good question. The last of the letters, the one I mentioned from probably 1414, is the only one who says something explicit about her ethnicity, if we should call it that. It says that she herself says that she is born among the Popolo. I think they say the Popolo Lapinorum, and they are heathens. So there it is made explicit. I think in a way it's quite interesting. We tend to be very focused on that thing. And she's, of course, nowadays, and maybe rightly, celebrated as an early important Sami religious and political actor, and something that is important to recognize, of course. But when that particular thing is not mentioned in the other letters, and even in the one then from the queen says that she's a Molier Uppsalensis diocese, in a way, what was relevant here was that she was in the Uppsala diocese. That's what counted. And what is relevant about the Sami are perhaps not anything about a different ethnicity, but the fact that some of them are heathen. And so those are the things that count, you know, organizationally, she's part of the Uppsala diocese, and this is a religious matter. Of course, if you look at the historiography where she is mentioned from the 19th century and the early 20th century, they make a lot out of the kind of exotic nature of this story. And they write that, you know, she traveled far over mountains, through deep forests, where the wolves were still in the supreme and things like that. We actually have no idea how she traveled. But of course, it tickles our imagination somehow to think of this. Also, we don't know exactly how far north she came from. We must assume that she originated somewhere where there were churches, at least nearby. And the Sami population back then, also there might have been Sami people fairly far south. But we don't know. We don't know much about this.
So obviously, given the sources that we have available, we're dealing with a very constructed version of who she was and her character. But with that in mind, what kinds of things are they saying about who she was as an individual? What kind of person are they trying to portray her as?
I think that the impression that at least what they are trying to cast her as is humble, unlearned, simple, and maybe she was like that. Or maybe they are just playing with tropes that are quite typical in the Birgittine environment, because that's what you're supposed to be like. Of course, knowing a bit of her story, we must assume that she was a force to be reckoned with who went through all of this. She's also described, of course, because for her long wanderings and things that you would expect, her tears, you know, her worries, her suffering for others. It's always difficult with historical actors, and I guess especially with characters like this, to know if they are describing expectations on the role or if they're describing the actual person. And of course, one does not have to rule out the other one. I suppose we all model ourselves according to certain ideals that we try to emulate in our lives, and there's no reason to think that she did not.
No, that's a very fair point. We can't make any sorts of assumptions, especially when we have so little to go on. Speaking of these letters, we've been talking and talking about them. Would you mind sharing some of one of the letters with us?
Why don't we read what Friar Philip says about her? Because I think that it captures a lot of what is going on here. So Friar Philip, just to remind you, he was from Stockholm, and he is probably writing to Uppsala to make sure that she gets an audience with the Archbishop. But he's not writing directly to the Archbishop, but to someone who has access to him. So probably someone in the chapter, like the Dean. Friar Philip is also an interesting character because he shows up in other Vastena material. He has interesting ideas about himself. He has read Birgitta's revelations. And in one of them, Birgitta mentions that there is a Lord's hunter who blows his bugle to scare away the wolves and the beasts from the sheep. And he says that this is probably a reference to me and my calling as a preacher. And he makes another similar suggestion. So he is someone who is deeply embedded in this Birgittine mystique. And he writes about Margareta the following. Since God makes wonders through the weaker sex, as is apparent in the case of Blessed Birgitta and other holy women, the carrier of this letter, Margareta, who through her many wanderings and labors a long time has suffered for the conversion of the infidels among the Laplanders, she should not be spurned but heard with patience. Even though she might accomplish little, maybe she is used by God as a tool, so that those who could but do not care of the souls will realize that they are slothful. I think it kind of sums up the whole idea.
Wow, he is really throwing some shade there. Those who can and should but don't. Like, that's very pointed.
Yeah, exactly. It's like sticking the knife into the side of the Archbishop there.
I love that learning about Margareta has brought in so many additional fun characters, like the queen having prophetic dreams, this friar not only just fully going for the Archbishop, but also this idea that he was like, oh yes, Birgitta had this vision about a shepherd guiding people, and that's me.
With all likelihood, that's him. But it's interesting because I think maybe it shows also how this mystical idiom is also used and employed all the time, you know, by people who try to perhaps understand themselves, but also try to promote themselves, or in Margareta's case, who try to promote a particular idea or a mission like this improve church activity in the north. It's a discourse that can be employed, and it's part of raising the authority of individuals and particular agendas.
Absolutely. And with regards to this mission of hers, do we know if she had any success? I mean, do we see an increase in pastoral care in the north at this time? Or does the archbishop just continue to ignore it?
It's hard to gauge, of course, but we know that there is another missionary sent who, with all likelihood, is from Bastena. He's not one of the Brigittine brothers, but he is probably from a church that is under the patronage of Bastena. And he is sent up north in 1414 or thereabouts. So not long after we get the last sign of life that we have from Margareta with this last letter from Bastena. So that might be one, at least one indication that this goes on and there is still an interest. And when we come to the early 1500s, in the mid-1520s, there is actually a Brigittine brother who travels himself up north. So there's reason to think that perhaps there is in Vastena still an interest, and there is a long, in a way, tradition of an interest in the subarctic and the Sami people, and the sense that they ought really to be up there and promote the reform of the church in the same way as they are doing in the rest of the country.
So even if we can't say that she is the direct cause of this sustained interest, the fact that interest remains and that missionary work and an increase in the potential for pastoral care continues is something that is attached to her legacy in some respect. That is fantastic. Now we are coming towards the end, so we only have the one final question, which is, why is Margareta your favorite mystic? What is it about her that you find so intriguing?
You can't fail to be impressed, can you? If you think about this individual, and if we write about dating, that she actually did exactly what they say about her, that she roamed the country trying to gain interest for this work up north. Someone like that, I think, is worthy of interest and a lot of respect. But then, of course, it's the fact, I think, as an historian, that when you look at her, she becomes the nexus of all these interesting things. So there's the political power struggle with the arrival of Queen Margareta. You have the large church political story with Birgitta and the relationship between visionaries like her and the leadership of the church. You have perhaps smaller tensions within the Swedish church between Uppsala and the Brigittines. And there are so many things that somehow they all meet in this character of Margareta. Gender issues, of course, is another one of those. You know, what are the role of women in this church? What other ways do they have to influence if they don't happen to be the queen, unless by employing this mystical idiom? So she and her mysticism, if we call it that, is just a window into so many other issues, political and religious, in medieval history.
What a beautiful way to sum up the beauty of studying mystics. Bjorn, thank you so much for joining me today and for telling me all about Margareta and all of the other fascinating characters that come along with this story. It has been an absolute pleasure having you.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you all so much for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at MyFaveMystic. And join me next month when I talk to Delphi Nieto Isabel about Na Prosponeta.